I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. New polls out today show President Bush heading into next week's convention with a slight lead. So slight is a statistical dead heat, but the polls indicate that attack ads on John Kerry's war record are having a negative effect on Kerry in three important swing states. And while the president still gets high ratings for being likable, his support on several key campaign issues is slipping. Joining us is The Wall Street Journal's national political editor, John Harwood. And John, The Wall Street Journal and NBC News commissioned one of these new polls. What did you find?
Robin, the good news for the president in this poll is that he has a 2 percentage point lead over John Kerry, and John Kerry has failed to make headway in convincing a larger proportion of the American people that he's ready to be commander-in-chief. Both of those are important. The problems for President Bush are that his policies are not popular right now. On jobs and the economy, on health care, and on Iraq, you have a majority of Americans saying it's time to change course. That creates a low ceiling for the president as he tries to expand his support above where it is now.
We should add as well, a new LA Times poll says that in three key swing states, Ohio, Wisconsin, and Missouri, voters are leaning towards President Bush. Interestingly, voters who saw the attack ads on John Kerry are leaning towards John Kerry. Voters who haven't seen them but heard about them relentlessly on right-wing radio talk shows are leaning towards Bush. But there are also warning signs in those LA Times polls for Bush. Slightly more voters disapprove of his handling of the economy. Tell us more about voters' thoughts on the economy.
Voters are very concerned about the economy right now. The whole specter of lost jobs, of jobs that have come back with wages that didn't match the jobs that were there before, of jobs without health care, are leaving a lot of people very, very worried about their economic future. We see in our survey that 60% of Americans say conditions are not improving for middle and working class families, and nearly that many say that the president's tax cuts have mostly benefited the wealthy rather than middle class Americans. Those are worrisome numbers for the president.
Your poll also says that President Bush is going to have a hard time wooing undecided voters. Now, that was interesting to us because we heard analyst David Gergen say that Karl Rove, the president's advisor, has basically decided to give up on the undecideds. There aren't enough of them, and to really go after the base.
Well, that's true. And the question is, can you turn out the base? That's not easy to do. Most campaigns in the past that have focused on jacking up turnout among partisans have found it very difficult because voters have many reasons why they don't end up turning out in the end. This is a novel strategy that the president's team is pursuing. They're pursuing it in a sophisticated way.
John Harwood, one last question for you after your Wall Street Journal NBC poll. It points out that President Bush does very well on the issue of terrorism and fighting terrorism, but not on Iraq, as you said. But many would say the administration has, for the last few years, said that the two were basically one and the same. So where's that split?
Well, that's a problem for them because the public does not see it as one and the same necessarily. They're very antsy about the costs of the war, both financially and in human terms, making that link between Iraq and the war on terrorism is a critical goal. The president will see that in his acceptance speech on Thursday night.
John, thank you.
You bet.
John Harwood, national political editor for The Wall Street Journal. Well, on Monday, Republicans in New York will vote on a party platform that nails down their beliefs. And unlike years past, few inside the party have seen the document. According to news reports, the platform largely endorses many of President Bush's ideas, from fighting terrorism to tax cuts, but has left some liberals and conservatives in the GOP unhappy about issues such as gay marriage and abortion. Steve Moore is president of the Conservative Political Action Committee, the Club for Growth. Steve, what do you think of the platform?
Well, of course, the Republican Party wants to avoid any controversy over this platform, and I think there won't be a whole lot of it. The one thing that really unifies this party right now is the defeat of John Kerry. You know, it's interesting if you look at the people who are speaking in the primetime slots for all the talk about how, this is a party that is taken over by the religious right and so on. I mean, you've got Arnold Schwarzenegger, you've got Rudy Giuliani, you've got John McCain. These are folks who are who tend to be, pro-choice on abortion. And so,
well, I tell you, you mentioned that there's going to be a little contention, but it seems a little late for that. Yesterday, we spoke to Pat Truman of the Family Research Council. He is not as affable as you sound about that moderate face on the convention. He said he's very disappointed, and it's a mistake of President Bush. He says President Bush ignores his conservative base at his peril.
Well, I don't think Bush is ignoring the conservative base. After all, George Bush is a conservative himself, and I think that the party really is pretty unified on most issues. I mean, certainly the party is totally in favor of cutting taxes. The party is in favor of doing something to reform Social Security. So I personally think that this is a more unified party than we've seen in the last 20 years.
Well, let's take a look at that platform. Social conservatives won a few key battles on the platform, but they lost a few. Failed to toughen the president's stand on research on existing stem cell lines. They wanted a full ban. Succeeded in keeping in a push for a constitutional amendment banning gay marriage and abortion. Mm-hmm. But a party unity plank, which would have stated that Republicans can disagree on issues such as abortion and gay rights, failed. And some are very upset about that.
That's exactly right. But I think that to have opened up that whole can of worms would have been even worse. It would have been totally divisive for the party. So I think it makes much more sense to focus this convention on the huge amount of issues that all Republicans agree on.
Steve, I want to ask you one last question. You mentioned that tax cuts is one of the topics that Republicans rally around. And yet a new poll that's just out, the Wall Street Journal NBC News poll, says that that's a problem for the president. By 55% to 38%, voters say the president's tax cuts mostly have benefited the wealthy rather than all Americans.
Well, Republicans have to do a better job of explaining the tax cut. I think it was a tax cut that re-energized the economy and that helped working families.
Russian security officials have found traces of explosives in the wreckage of one of two passenger planes that crashed within minutes of each other Tuesday night outside of Moscow. Officials are also looking into the background of two passengers with Chechen surnames. Joining us on the line from just outside of Moscow is Fred Weir of the Christian Science Monitor. Fred, the discovery of the explosive coincides with a web announcement from an Islamic extremist group. Do we know more about that?
There is this group that writes in Arabic, I think they're called the Islambouli Brigades or something, which no one has ever heard of. And I don't think that the FSB, which is the Russian Security Service, is taking that very seriously. And probably that's right. You know, anyone can put something up on the Internet. And it seems more likely that if this was terrorism, and it almost certainly was, that the origins of that are in Chechnya and the very complex situation there.
We understand authorities are looking at two passengers with one on each plane with Chechen surnames, and apparently the only two of the 89 killed in the crashes who haven't had relatives come forward looking for them.
Yeah, and also, oddly enough, don't seem to be on the passenger lists that the airlines put out earlier. There are so many peculiar things about this whole story, including the way the authorities tried to assert that it was a bizarre accident for 2 days. This business of the two Chechens, it's still, I think, there are mysteries here yet to be uncovered.
Well, this all takes place on the eve of elections in Chechnya. What is the thinking there?
Yes, there are elections on Sunday in Chechnya. It's all fixed. There will be almost no international observers there. And the Kremlin's appointed guy, Alu Alkanov, who is a tough policeman, will almost certainly be elected. And I think that probably the best explanation for why the Kremlin did downplay the terrorism theory in this airplane crashes was to avoid any kind of public panic or attention to the situation in Chechnya on the eve of these elections. Mm.
The election is to replace the president who was killed in a bombing in May. And, of course, for many, it just conjures images of the bombing in Madrid several days before the Spanish election. Not to draw too fine a point on it, but is there any thinking that they may somehow be connected?
Yes, I think we're living in an age where terrorists network over the Internet and they form global organizations just as businesses and governments and everybody uses this technology. And so I don't doubt the possibility that Chechen Islamic fundamentalists and terrorists are also networking with their counterparts around the world and learning new skills and bringing them to Russia. It's not the origins of the problem there, but it's one of the complicating factors.
Fred Weir of the Christian Science Monitor speaking to us from just outside of Moscow. Fred, thank you.
welcome.
Citing a judging error, the head of the International Gymnastics Federation has asked U.S. gold medal winner Paul Hamm to give up the coveted award he won last week. Officials suggested in a letter that Hamm make the noble gesture of giving the medal to South Korea's Yang Tae-young, who won the bronze. The U.S. Olympic Committee's response? No. For more on the story, we turn to John Powers. He's sports reporter for the Boston Globe. John, in Athens there, fill us in on some of the details. What's going on?
Well, we thought this was a dead issue last week. We thought it was a dead issue each of the last 3 days. And what's happening is that every day, the International Gymnastics Federation says it's a dead issue, that they won't change results, that wouldn't it be nice if Paul Hamm gave up the gold medal? Paul has refused to, and finally the U.S. Olympic Committee, which probably should have stood behind Paul Hamm a week ago, said no, no chance, and not only that, they won't even consider the idea of a duplicate gold medal, which was on the table before.
We understand that the Olympic Committee members are saying that they do regret that they should have stood behind Hamm further, but the letter that was sent to him, do we understand that it said, "Dear Paul," but above it, it had big block letters that said, "Fair play"?
Of course. Well, I think that's the whole idea here, is that they would like to make him feel guilty about something he should not feel guilty about at all. And that, I think, has been the worst thing here, is that a man who won the gold medal straight up is being killed somehow to feel as though that is tarnished, that is unsavory. And I think that it makes everybody involved look badly. The IOC for not shutting this down on day one, the USOC for not standing behind him, USA Gymnastics for the same thing. It's just, what's a sour taste in all concerned who watched that event.
And John, remind those who didn't follow this, there was a technical error, a judging error that raised the controversy in the first place?
Well, what happened was the judges neglected to give the Korean the proper start value for his routine. It should have been 1/10 higher. What happens in that case is if you want a protest, you have to do it then, before the event ends, not after. The Koreans did not do that. Further than that, what the judges missed that was worse was a big mistake by the Korean that they should have taken 2/10 off for. So he should not have been in the medals at all. The Korean should have been fourth, not first. But what they say is that when it's over, it's over. And the question here is, why isn't it over then?
Well, we just have a few seconds left, but Paul Hamm, we know, is back in the States. His agent isn't commenting. What happens now?
Basically, unless they want to come to Waukesha, Wisconsin with a big army, Paul's going to keep that medal, as he should. So I think when they blow out the candle here on Sunday night, it's a dead issue.
Okay. Well, but will it tinge his award? Will it taint it?
Only to those who don't know gymnastics. I mean, basically, when the event's over, it's over. Whether or not a mistake was made. Yeah. It wasn't noticed at the time. It was noticed later after the Korean messed up his last routine. So I think it is a travesty that this was ever even brought up at all.
John
and
Powers.
And it all ought to be on the head of the International Gymnastics Federation.
John, thanks so much.
Thank you.
John Powers, sports reporter for the Boston Globe, speaking to us from Athens. Stay with us. More ahead. Coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Yasser Arafat, the man known as the father of the armed Palestinian struggle, met yesterday in Ramallah with one of the trademark names of peaceful resistance, Arun Gandhi, grandson of Mahatma Gandhi. After the meeting, Arafat looked on silently as Gandhi told reporters that Palestinians could have achieved peace and equality with Israelis decades ago had they chosen nonviolence over violence. Gandhi has spent the last few days speaking at rallies in various Palestinian cities at the invitation of an Arab peace group. He is president of the M.K. Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence in Memphis, Tennessee, and we spoke with Mr. Gandhi at his hotel in Jerusalem on Wednesday. Well, Mr. Gandhi, what do you hope to accomplish with Palestinians?
Well, I came here on the invitation of the Palestinians for Peace and Democracy. It's a new organization, and they're looking for ways to resolve this conflict peacefully. They invited me, and I took this opportunity because I also want to study the problem here. I've read about it, but not actually seen it or experienced it.
What I've read, both your and your grandfather's words about nonviolence, it has to do with seeing conflict as a personal issue. That would seem to be another challenge in this area where people see it as more, a territorial issue or an issue of a group of people as opposed to the personal. How do you change that way of thinking?
Well, it's true that your grandfather believed that to practice nonviolence, you have to, accept the philosophy of nonviolence and create that kind of culture of nonviolence around you. If you subscribe to violence, you cannot practice nonviolence, and vice versa. And I think it's possible to do that. The Palestinians have a nonviolent background. They did start off, and they do practice nonviolence on many occasions. And I don't think it's difficult for any people anywhere in the world to accept this philosophy because it's practical, not only morally right, it's practically right. I mean, the Palestinians just don't have the means to fight Israel on an equal footing in a war. They don't have an army, they don't have the weapons, and they don't have international backing. Mm. So for practical reasons, it makes sense for them to find another way, and the only other way seems to be nonviolence.
Yeah. We read also that part of nonviolence, practicing nonviolence, is learning respect and compassion and love even for the other. Have you, when you have conversations with Palestinians about that, do they argue with you on that point?
Some of them do, yes. I have argued with this on several occasions in the last few days. But I find a large number of young people. I just addressed a crowd of about 300 young people this evening, and I spoke to them about this, and all of them came up and shook my hands and said, this is a wonderful idea, and they want to pursue it. They wanted me to suggest what they should do, and I said, I can't do that because I don't know all the difficulties you are facing, and I don't know the strengths and weaknesses of your society. It is for somebody from within you to see this philosophy, understand it properly, and then find ways of implementing it in your own life.
It's interesting. I'm reading a quote from your grandfather, Mahatma Gandhi. Just before he was assassinated in 1948, he was asked, what is the solution to the Palestine problem? And that was the way the question was phrased, the solution to the Palestine problem. He replied, it has become a problem which seems almost insoluble. If I were a Jew, I would tell them, do not be so silly as to resort to terrorism. The Jews should meet with the Arabs, make friends with them, and not depend on British or American aid. And it goes on. Does that...
Well,
go ahead.
No, I agree. He said that, and he said earlier in 1938, when he dissuaded the Jews from going into Palestine with force, he said, you should not go there with force. You should not use the good officers of the British military and go and conquer the land. You should go and talk to the Arabs and convince them about your need for the land.
But can you see how to people today, that kind of thinking, those statements might seem excruciatingly simplistic?
Well, it could be, but sometimes simple things make more sense than complex things. We tend to make all problems very complex, and sometimes it's just a simple act of kindness that makes a big difference.
We know that that Israelis are split over the issue of the Palestinians and the wall and the settlements and all of the questions of that area of the world. And we hear that increasingly Palestinians are reacting in anger to violence from Palestinians.
Well, yeah, but they have to convince them. And once people who believe in this philosophy of nonviolence begin to act and achieve results, then, people will be more convinced and accept it. It's just like in India when grandfather was operating. There were many people at that time who were young and rebellious and wanted to redefine the philosophy of nonviolence and throw stones and blow bridges and do all kinds of things. which grandfather objected to. And yet they did do those things on a smaller scale, but they were not very effective because immediately they did that, they were arrested and put away in prison for a long period. So, you know, once you begin the process, then even the hardliners will begin to join. And that will motivate the liberal Israeli people to support this movement.
Arun Gandhi, thanks so much for talking to us about your trip to Jerusalem.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on your show.
Arun Gandhi, president of the Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence. Next week on Here and Now, we'll report from Madison Square Garden, scene of the Republican National Convention, and the view from the boardwalk, politics as discussed at New York's Jones Beach. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In the days before the Democratic convention in Boston last month, residents planned to clear out of town. Businesses dreamed of a windfall. It didn't come. And police braced for protesters. They, by and large, didn't come either. So what are New Yorkers anticipating as Republicans start arriving in droves today for next week's national convention? WBUR's Monica Brady-Meyerhoff has our story.
Republicans should be warned their convention is in unfriendly political territory. Registered Democrats in New York City outnumber Republicans by more than 5-1. And a poll this month by a Manhattan public relations firm finds 83% of New Yorkers do not want the Republican convention in town. And they don't mince words about it.
They don't like it because of the security of setting the whole business pattern here of can't deliver merchandise to that area, can't get off the trains, you're going to have to go to a different area.
It's a big pain in the ass, especially since I'm not a Republican, so I don't give a hoot. They're all a bunch of Texans anyway, right? So they should have their party down in Texas.
Conversely, Bostonians were excited to host their first national political convention. New York City has hosted 6 such events since 1868. But as in Boston, New Yorkers are concerned about safety, traffic, and the real economic benefits of holding a convention in the post-9/11 world. Typically, 3 million people visit New York City each month, so Mayor Michael Bloomberg says it will not be paralyzed by an additional 50,000 visitors for the RNC.
Boston fundamentally said, take a vacation. We want to close down the city for a week. New York fundamentally has said, go about your business and you'll be able to do so.
Bloomberg says the city will make $265 million from the convention, but a report from the comptroller's office says New York stands to lose about $309 million. Although Boston Mayor Tom Menino says otherwise, a post-convention study in Boston concluded it netted 1/10 of what was expected. So it's no surprise New Yorkers are pessimistic. A few blocks from Madison Square Garden, the convention site, a sign in the window of J.G. Hair Salon says it will be closed during convention week. Owner Gerardo Spioto says business will be slow, and he wants to be safe.
I don't think it's going to bring any business, at least in this area. If it's bringing business, it will be in hotels, a restaurant, maybe uptown, certain areas, but not in this area.
Spiotta says almost three-quarters of his neighbors tell him they're planning to close during the RNC because they're located in the so-called safety zone, which will be closed to traffic. Kitty corner from the garden is the New Yorker Hotel, where managing director Kevin Smith says even he's not optimistic about the economic benefits. Smith says the RNC first held 650 rooms, but only booked 350.
Yeah, we don't think that the RNC will bring as much as was initially promised, but for our particular business and hotel, you know, we do believe we'll be sold out during that time because of the proximity to the garden. But generally speaking, for Manhattan, I don't know that it'll bring as much as was hoped for.
One of the reasons New Yorkers aren't expecting much is that they fear disruptions from protests. Organizers anticipate 250,000 people will hold demonstrations at various places around the city. That's in comparison with Boston, where police say about 2,000 people staged demonstrations near the Fleet Center. The hub of protest planning in New York is the loft headquarters of United for Peace and Justice, which is organizing a large march on Sunday. The rally is permitted to go along the West Side Highway near the Garden. Lisa Fithian, national co-chair for UPJ, says the Republican convention draws protesters from all over the country.
There are going to be tens of thousands of people from every races, religions, ages, genders, geographies. I mean, we're expecting grandmothers, immigrants, young people, workers.
The official protest zone for the RNC is outside Madison Square Garden, and Fithian says it will be blocked off by metal bicycle racks, not high fences as in Boston.
Well, I don't think we're going to see an internment camp, at least not a physical one in the streets, but clearly there's a mental one that's being created here. You know, we are seeing in New York an intensive, preemptive media campaign to create fear, to chill dissent, and to create a sense of chaos.
Boston's protest zone was compared with an internment camp because it was surrounded by two 12-foot-high fences and had netting and razor wire overhead. It's clearly a point of pride for New Yorkers that their free speech zone is so unlike Boston's. Again, Mayor Bloomberg.
We've given permits to people, to even the 250,000 people who want to protest on Sunday. In one group, we've offered them a permit. They can walk right, literally, next to Madison Square Garden.
Bloomberg is even trying to make protesters feel welcome by giving out buttons that say, "Peaceful political activist," to people who don't cause problems. Wearing the button will get them discounts at some restaurants and hotels. But the New York branch of the American Civil Liberties Union says it's deeply concerned about how police will behave during demonstrations. Donna Lieberman is the executive director of the NYCLU.
Both Boston and New York have some lessons to learn. Boston certainly set a low standard for protecting protest with its ridiculous razor wire pens.
NYCLU has opened a storefront near Madison Square Garden to serve as a base of operations for their volunteers, monitoring police conduct during street demonstrations. And Lieberman says they're giving out information to protesters so they'll know their rights. She holds up a pocket-sized pamphlet.
What to do if you're stopped by the police, the RNC edition. It focuses on what to do during demonstrations, your rights and ways to respond to police interference or inquiry.
In Boston, police made six convention-related arrests. New York is preparing for many more. Boston Police Commissioner Kathleen O'Toole.
Many are predicting that New York will face greater challenges than we did, given the venue and the fact that it's the RNC. You know, my hope is that they'll be pleasantly surprised, too.
Security in New York is expected to be even tighter than in Boston. The security bill for the RNC will be higher, too, upwards of $100 million. It was estimated at $50 million for the DNC. Despite the higher cost in New York, there will be fewer road and rail closures and no bag searches on the subway. Boston closed North Station and 40 miles of highway to protect conventioners. But Penn Station will be open, even though trains stop below Madison Square Garden. New Jersey transit riders who arrive at Penn Station will be slowed down considerably because every train will be inspected before it enters the station. It's enough to force Rich, who's from Middletown, New Jersey, to take a vacation.
Right now, it takes me 2 hours to get here. If with all the extra security and confusion and whatever, it could take me 4 hours to get here and 4 hours to go home. So why bother come?
This New Jersey commuter is not alone. The same poll that found New Yorkers don't want the RNC showed 70% are afraid to go to work the week of the convention because of security. And so many New Yorkers are predicting what happened during the convention in Boston will also happen in New York. Locals will leave the city to the delegates and out-of-towners.
That report from WBUR's Monica Brady Meyerhoff in New York City. You're listening to Here and Now. It's time to open up the Here and Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts. Our segment on the Catholic parish in Newton, Massachusetts, struggling to stay open despite being ordered to close by the Archdiocese of Boston, brought this response from Bob Persons of Auburndale, Massachusetts. He writes, "Your report failed to note the irony that the parishioners who are struggling to keep their churches open have chosen a hierarchical religion in which the higher-ups purportedly have better access to God's will." Well, Ron Gregory of Boston called after our interview with the New York Daily News reporter who discovered thousands of voters registered in both New York and Florida, with as many as 1,000 voting in both places. We pointed out that many were elderly, and Ron objected to our tone.
Not all elderly people are senile. Some of us are quite alert, and we're darn aware of where we vote and for whom we vote. And we don't go around voting in two places without having a clue about what we're doing.
And listener Timothy Frost of Arlington, Massachusetts, reminds us that double registration is not just for the elderly. She writes, "I registered to vote in New York City when I was 18, moved to the Boston area when I was 26, and up until about 2 years ago was legally registered in both places. I kept sending mail saying that I had moved and registered in Massachusetts, but they kept sending my parents mail that indicated that I was still registered in New York City. And when my parents went to vote, I was still on the lists." No, I did not vote in both states, by the way. And finally, yesterday, we spent some time talking about the impact of Vietnam on the current presidential campaign. We spoke with a member of the anti-Kerry group, Swift Boat Veterans for Truth, and with authors Stanley Karnow and Tim O'Brien, who both supported John Kerry's actions in and after the war. Taylor Armerding of Ipswich, Massachusetts, writes, "O'Brien says Kerry displayed great courage to criticize the war when he came back. Not true. As one who is from his generation, I remember him being lionized by the media. He was treated like a rock star. It is the Swift Boat vets who are showing courage, since they are being relentlessly attacked in the mainstream media. Also, if Tim wants to defend Kerry's statements by saying that this is a country where people are allowed to say what they want to say, why doesn't he grant that same right to the Swift Boat vets instead of just trashing them?" But Bonnie Boswell of Whitefield, New Hampshire, disagreed and wrote, "Your interview moved me to tears. It strikes me that we will indeed be talking about and crying about Vietnam for many years to come. George W. Bush did not volunteer to serve in Vietnam. Mr. Bush joined the National Guard, which in the Vietnam draft era saw little combat. But he has led us into the morass in Iraq. How dare he and his party condemn a man who really did risk his life?" Well, several of you wanted to know the name of the music played at the end of that segment on Vietnam. It was Samuel Barber's Adagio for Strings, Opus 11. We'd love to hear your thoughts about anything on the program. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name, phone number, and town. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Donnie Yen might be a new face to American audiences, but in Hong Kong, he's been a well-recognized martial arts star since the early 80s, appearing in over 50 action movies. Well, now Yen appears in the new and highly anticipated film Hero by famed Chinese director Zhang Yimou. It's the story of a warrior named Nameless, played by superstar Jet Li, and it's a film of contradictions. Nameless is or isn't going to assassinate the King of Qin, and he may or may not be meeting with three other assassins along the way to either kill them or recruit them. Yen plays the assassin Sky and does battle that feels more like ballet, in one scene taking on seven men. The sounds of actor Donnie Yen in the film Hero, and Donnie joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Hello.
What a beautiful movie. It's sort of a mix of history. There's a partially true story, but this phantasmagoric, in the fight scenes, you're flying. You're
right.
On the. Tell me more about it.
Basically, martial art films from my part of the culture, Chinese culture in general, tends to dramatize everything from their languages, from their writings, from their art. So therefore, it's only natural for filmmakers to make their characters in these movies over the top.
Right, bigger than life.
Bigger than life. You can't explain it in the scientific terms.
Well, can you try to explain it? Again, it's the story of a warrior named Nameless.
Right.
But what's driving it all are these battle/ballet scenes.
Right.
You're in one of them, as we mentioned. What is that like to physically make that scene?
Well, we didn't really have a sort of rehearsal or preparation for the scene because for several reasons. Number one, the filmmaking techniques is slightly different from in Western industry and Asian industry. The terms of choreographer in a Western Hollywood production would be choreographing a move and then let the director and the cinematographer take place. But as in Hong Kong, a choreographer is the director. Heroes is even more of an ultimate exception because you have someone like myself and Jet Li who's
You've trained
so many films.
But were you ever on wires? Because there's times when you're sailing across the room where you're having the fight. There's times when you're walking on a wall. Were you on wires?
We were on wire because the characters in the story required these characters to be larger than life.
Well, and we've been saying you were trained in the martial arts right here in Boston. This is a homecoming for you, right?
Sort of, yes. I grew up in Boston, and my mom teaches martial arts down Lincoln Street.
Oh, he casually says, as if your mother isn't the famed wushu master, Bo Sim Mark.
Indeed she is.
And explain for the uninitiated, wushu master, what does that mean?
Wushu meaning, that's just a Chinese interpretation of martial art.
Ah.
She's been teaching in the United States for 3 decades. Mm.
And when did you start?
A very early age for my mother. But besides studying for my mom, I was always wanted to be the next Bruce Lee. So I was always in quest of wanting to be the ultimate martial artist.
Yeah. But would you say, are you an actor as well? I mean, was that a passion as well?
No, or? Not at all. No? I never wanted to be an actor, but I think it was acting who chose me. It was the industry who chose me.
But what's that like, though? Because, as you said, you sort of stumbled into this. And as we've noted, your face, when you walk around in China, for instance,
right, right.
Do people know who you are?
quite a few, actually. Actually, the only place I find a piece of sense of relaxation is, say, coming back here.
Yeah.
And coming because I'm still kind of new to the industry.
Well, you said you are comfortable in the quiet of Boston, but you haven't bumped into my 11-year-old nephew yet, who's a huge fan of yours. But do you think that the success and the projected success of Hero is going to mean that there's going to be more martial arts in movies? Or is it something that you worry might also be sort of knocked off and maybe not as attractive
well,
a way?
Well, I think everything goes through a process. You know, I think martial arts is here to stay because martial arts is no longer a Asian thing. And it's going to take more movie like Hero to really change the conception of how martial art has been perceived throughout many decades.
The accent on the art in martial arts, because it's just beautiful. Donnie Yen, thank you.
Thank you.
martial arts star Donnie Yen. Now, Hero opens nationwide in theaters today, but it's not a new movie. It was completed and released in China in 2002. And now we turn to Hero Now film reviewer Ted Barron for a review, but we start with a question. Ted, what took Hero so long to get here?
Well, that's the big question. The film was finished in 2002. It was nominated for the Academy Award that same year.
Broke the box office records in China.
Yeah, apparently, which I guess is a really big deal because there's a large prevalence of pirating of films in China, so box office numbers tend to be much lower than what you see in other countries. Miramax purchased the domestic rights to the film around the time that it was completed, and for some reason have been sitting on it for the last couple of years. I'm not sure if it's because of the language issue, but I think the other bigger issue is probably the fact that it came in the wake of Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, which was such a huge success, and they were worried about the film being seen as a kind of copycat mm-hmm. of that earlier work.
Well, and what do you think, for those who haven't seen either film?
I can understand why the comparisons are made to Crouching Tiger. I mean, there are very specific scenes which look like Crouching Tiger. You have a fight sequence which takes a place on treetops.
Oh, it's amazing.
Yeah, it's beautiful. And there's all this wire work in the film, which it seems to be very commonly used now in a lot of the sort of newer martial arts works. But the story is quite different. In fact, the story actually draws back to a much earlier source. It draws on Akira Kurosawa's Rashomon, where you have sort of multiple storylines being interwoven, which contradict each other and don't really sort of give you the full story in terms of what happened. So you come out of the film sort of not sure what really happened.
I know. Is some of it true, though? As I said, it's the story of a warrior named Nameless who either is going to accept an award from the king or going to kill the king. He mm-hmm. either enlists or kills different other assassins along the way on his trip. Is any of it true?
Well, that's the big question coming out of it. I mean, I think this film raises questions about how we understand sort of truthful actions in a film. But what's interesting is that it does it using some of the most stylized sequences that you'll see in recent memory. I mean, one of the things that sort of sets apart each of these narrative threads is this use of a very sort of strong color scheme. You have, distinct colors being used to mark different elements of story.
Well, several of Zhang Yimou's other films were banned in China for their political content. I'm thinking of To Live and Raise the Red Lantern. And in this film, the king talks about how he wants a unified country under him as emperor, of course. Is there a political statement there?
You know, it's interesting because this film is sort of being described as Zhang Yimou's first real mainstream film, and he's described it as his attempt to sort of appeal to a more of a mass audience than he had done in his previous works, which were have very strong political content. I did actually find sort of an element of politics in this because this idea of a united China seems to play into this modern notion of Chinese identity, how it's sort of split between mainland China, Taiwan, and Hong Kong, all of which are represented in different ways in the film. Interestingly, that you have a Chinese filmmaker working with a predominantly Hong Kong cast, big stars of Hong Kong cinema, too, people mm-hmm. like Jet Li, Maggie Cheung, Tony Leung, Donnie Yen. So I do think this call for unification that kind of comes up in a peaceful way that emerges at the end of the film might be a way to address some of those modern questions of national identity.
Mm. So we've talked about the martial arts. Mm-hmm. What about the acting?
I'm kind of mixed on the acting because the film sort of misses. There's not a lot of character development in the film, so you don't really get very attached to these people as individuals. They seem to sort of exist more as types.
But overall, I mean, I just found that visually so spectacular.
Well, it is. It's really a big screen experience. I mean, this is something, don't wait for this to come out on video if you're going to go see it, because the elements of color and the fight scenes themselves, which I found to be, the comparison to Crouching Tiger comes up again, actually much more interesting and much more, they're so much more bombastic than what you see in Crouching Tiger, which kind of had this sort of quiet grace to it. This film is much more audacious in the way that it presents those things. The story is a bit thin, and I wonder actually how much of it was cut. I mean, part of the, one of the things that happens when these films sit on the shelf for so long is they probably go through a series of edits, and I wonder if Miramax didn't pressure the filmmaker to cut some of the scenes that, gave us more of a sense of who these people were coming into this situation.
Ted Barron, thanks for your thoughts on Hero.
Thank you, Robin.
Ted Barron, Hero Now film reviewer and also film programmer at the Harvard Film Archive. Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Get into your radio and join us again. Here and Now. For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.